All right, let's go ahead and get this show on the road. Make sure that you're in the right room. The title of this session is Evolving Media Perceptions of Four 2012 Mormon Presidential Contenders. And frankly, I didn't know that some of these were presidential contenders. Maybe you all did. Mitt Romney, John Huntsman, Rocky Anderson, and Roseanne Barr. And we're going to hear from two speakers and a respondent. Our first speaker will be Newell Bringhurst. Our first speaker will be Craig Foster. Our second speaker will be Newell Bringhurst. And then the respondent will be William Russell. I'll introduce each of them as we go along. So first let me introduce Craig Foster. As you can, Craig, he earned his MA and his MLIS. What is that, MLIS?
Library and Information Science.
Library Information Science. I hadn't heard of that before. At BYU.
You can need this now. It's there.
Thank you. He's the author of two books, co-author with Newell, so apparently they've known each other from this co-authoring, The Mormon Quest for the Presidency, from Joseph Smith to Mitt Romney, and John Huntsman. Okay, so that's the full title right there. Excuse me. Quest for the Presidency, from Joseph Smith to Mitt Romney and John Huntsman. And then he's also the co-editor with Newell, so a second book here. And the title of that book is The Persistence of Polygamy. And I think there's a subtitle on that one, if I remember. Joseph Smith and the Origins of Modern Polygamy. So we're happy to hear from Craig. And he'll be speaking about Mitt Romney, the first of the four.
In my 2003 book, A Different God, Mitt Romney, The Religious Right and the Mormon Question, as well as the latest edition of The Mormon Quest for the Presidency, from Joseph Smith to Mitt Romney and John Huntsman, which I co-authored with Newell G. Bringhurst, I discuss the anti-Mormon bigotry manifested by some conservatives on the religious right, but suggested that should Mitt Romney win the Republican nomination, he would experience as much, if not more, bigotry from the left of the political spectrum. Well, I have picked on the right long enough. Today's presentation will highlight how the left has addressed the so-called Mormon question. Romney's 2012 quest for the presidency was hard fought among his fellow Republican candidates, and there are still plenty of conservatives who not only do not support his candidacy, but are still doing all they can to thwart Romney's political ambitions. There are varying reasons for their dislike of Romney, but it is mostly because of Romney's Mormonism, at least for the ones that I'm going to mention here. Thus, people like the Reverend Bill Keller, the Reverend Stephen Andrew, Steve Deese, and Brian Fisher continue to speak out against Romney. Still, early on, voices on the right warned about the coming attack from the left. The American Spectator wrote, quote, "The media's preoccupation with anti-Mormon sentiment on the right has distracted from what is arguably a much more pervasive anti-Mormonism on the secular left," end quote. Another writer portrayed the impending liberal attacks against Mormonism, quote, "The big dog that has yet to bark and surely will by October," end quote. As expected, some on the left have begun to attack not only Mitt Romney's politics, but also his religion. Some of the attacks are very subtle, while others are not. The majority of these attacks have fallen into several themes that seem to ebb and wane depending upon what is being discussed on the larger national stage. I will discuss several of these topics or themes in today's paper. But first, to set it up a little bit. A recent Gallup poll found that approximately 18% of Americans would not vote for a Mormon for president. Of that number, 10% were Republicans and 24% were Democrats. In fact, a poll conducted by the University of Sydney found liberal anti-Mormonism has skyrocketed since 2007. This poll estimated Mormon-averse voters among liberals to be a staggering 43% in 2012. Despite the significant difference in poll numbers, the fact is still the same. Mitt Romney's Mormonism is a stumbling block for a significant percentage of liberal voters. An oft-repeated complaint by voters and media about Mormonism is that little to nothing about the religion is known to those outside it, and it seems to be purposefully kept under wraps and never discussed in public. Romney and his fellow Mormons are both perceived and portrayed by critics on the left as weird by the voters and especially the media. Even articles that are basically even-handed sometimes bring up the weird factor. More biased writers refer to Romney's religion as bizarre, spectacularly weird, dangerous nonsense, far out with bizarre world beliefs, and a wackadoo religion. I especially liked the wackadoo religion. Many Americans are uninformed and wary of Mormonism. Amazingly, in this age of complex worldwide communication, the LDS Church and its adherents are still mysterious and misunderstood to many Americans. As J. Spencer Fluman stated, quote, "Any religion looks weird from the outside, but the image of Mormonism seems caught somewhere between perpetual strangeness and straight-laced blandness," end quote. Walter Russell Mead went even further. Quote, "To many people, the Mormon religion feels at once hyper-American and un-American. It is apple pie and secret underwear. It is Doris Day on the outside and Carmen Miranda within," end quote. It is this combination of perceived strangeness on the part of the Mormons and suspicion by those outside looking in that, much like some on the religious right and their publications, some people on the left, especially those in the media, play on. Naturally, accusations of left-leaning media bias against Romney and Mormonism have come mostly from the right. Cal Thomas, for example, wrote, quote, "Evidence of big media's bias against religion that doesn't advance the secular and liberal agenda of the Democratic Party is beyond dispute. Any faith attached to a conservative agenda is to be ridiculed, stereotyped, and misrepresented," end quote. Another conservative commentator, Doug Giles, in an opinion piece titled, "The Media That Ignored Obama's Beliefs Goes After Mitt's Mormonism," complained, quote, "The same media that ignored information about Obama's racist religious roots steeped in Marxism is already queuing up with queries about Romney's Mormonism is somehow being weird and a tad white," end quote. Alex Perrine, writer for Salon.com and author of The Rude Guide to Mitt, warned of such possible reaction in an article titled The Coming War on Mormon Jokes. He warned that, quote, "Liberals are about to be accused of mass bigotry," end quote. And by the end of the presidential campaign, everyone who has ever made a magic underwear joke will be declared an intolerant liberal bigot, end quote. After the aforementioned study came out about liberal anti-Mormon bigotry, Perrine published an article complaining about BuzzFeed's McKay Coppins discussing the study and then reminded readers how he had promised there would be, quote, "a dedicated effort to prove that liberals are constantly engaging in anti-Mormon bigotry." Still, most of the published examples of what would be considered questionable comments and portrayals by the left motivated one conservative to write, quote, "Liberal media has taken the blows and Mormon bashing to a new low," end quote. Okay, so the previous statements that I have read, obviously, are certainly more hyperbole than reality. Some publications and media entities, though, have not only addressed political and other problems of Romney, but, as some conservatives have charged, have obsessed with Romney's Mormonism. In the process, they and others have seemed to dwell on certain aspects or themes of Mormonism. Mormons will always be linked with its polygamous past. And like Romney's 2008 presidential run, there have been plenty of allusions to polygamy. Here are a few examples among the numerous references. One liberal member of the media, who has continuously showed a disdain for aspects of the LDS faith, quote, a disdain for aspects of the LDS faith, end quote, while bringing up Mormonism's and Romney and the Romney family's polygamous past, is Lawrence O'Donnell. While explaining how Miles Park Romney had moved to Mexico to continue to practice plural marriage, O'Donnell claimed the Romney family history is, quote, profoundly weirder than you would think, end quote. Several times on his television show and elsewhere, O'Donnell referred to Joseph starting polygamy because, quote, his first wife caught him having an affair with the maid, end quote. One time, he said Smith had 33 wives, and then the next time, he claimed Smith had 48. O'Donnell's comments were so over the top that Kevin D. Williamson of National Review, which of course you know is a conservative periodical, awarded O'Donnell the Golden Ass Award because he is, quote, an assiness auris, if ever there was one, an ass of exceptional asininity, end quote. Bill Maher, who's outspoken...
Back up a little bit from the microphone because of the...
Sorry about that. I'll try back here. Is this a little bit better?
Yes.
Am I not blowing you all out? I apologize. Bill Maher, whose outspoken antipathy toward religion in general and Mormonism in particular has been described as, quote, half comedian, half political commentator, all theophobe, end quote, made a number of comments about different aspects of Mormonism, polygamy being one of his favorite. Describing the fall elections, Maher said Obama would beat Romney like a runaway sister wife. I'll have to admit, I did find that amusing. As an attempt to parody birthers questioning Barack Obama's birth certificate, Maher talked about the wifer controversy and speculated that Mitt Romney may have multiple wives. In explaining his wifer movement, Maher said, quote, now, I'm getting a lot of my information, I must say, from a book called Me So Romney, The Secret Love Life of the World's Horniest Mormon. Again, I'm not a wifer. I'm just saying that he has the blood of a nomadic polygamous tribesman, and I think that has shaped his worldview, end quote. O'Donnell and Maher were not the only involved in media to comment on polygamy. Wanda Sykes, appearing on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live, commented about her lesbian marriage, joked that they needed another wife just to help take care of the house. Quote, that's why I'm kind of leaning towards Romney right now. Kimmel and his audience thought this was hysterical. One of the most bizarre celebrity outbursts, though, about polygamy was when George Lopez, during an HBO special, said Romney would not get the Latino vote because he's, quote, an effing Latino, and he won't admit it. His father was born in Chihuahua, Mexico. Mitt Romney is a Chicano, but he won't admit it. If you want your vote, Puto, come out of the closet. His father, his grandfather, went to Mexico to create a Mormon colony. That don't sit good with Mexicans when you want six wives to get 12 kids. Effing Latinos can have one wife and get 12 kids. Don't effing cheat, end quote. Potentially inflammatory comments about Mormon polygamy extended beyond the media world. They were also expressed by some Democratic politicians. Montana's Democratic governor, Brian Schweitzer, talked about Romney's father being, quote, born into a polygamy commune in Mexico, end quote. A number of political commentators, as well as Mitt Romney, thought Schweitzer was suggesting Romney's grandfather had been a polygamist. In fact, Romney angrily replied, my dad's dad was not a polygamist. Schweitzer was not alone among Democratic elected officials who broached the polygamy question. North Carolina representative and chairwoman of the Legislative Black Caucus, Alma Adams, said, quote, from what I understand about the Mormon faith, you can have multiple wives. There are questions about who Romney is and what he believes in terms of that particular issue, end quote. Representative Adams, however, once she learned that that was not the case, she apologized for her statement. Another seemingly favorite topic of both conservative and liberal non-Mormons are the temple garments worn by Mitt Romney and other temple-going Latter-day Saints. In February of this year, liberal New York Times columnist Charles Blow became offended when he thought that Romney was condemning single-parent households, particularly single parents who are minorities, and tweeted about Romney, quote, "Stick that in your magic underwear," end quote. Cher, worrying that Obama might lose if he doesn't get all of his ducks in a row, then explained, "We'll be forced to listen to, quote, Richie Rich, the whitest man in magic underwear in the White House," end quote. Roger Ebert was another celebrity to tweet about temple garments by asking, "What's the deal with magic Mormon underwear?" About the same time, Salon.com published an article in which it stated, quote, "This is not to say that Mormon garments have no place in the history or future of erotica. Was the design of the garment the product of a divine revelation, Smith's sexual taste, or his effort to suppress desire? You decide," end quote. But the fun doesn't stop there. Earlier this year, a website advertised t-shirts with "Mitt Romney Magic Underpants 2012 USA Tour." The same website also had a Magic Mormon Undies t-shirt with a picture of white cotton briefs on the front. And another website called Mormon Secret advertises magical Mormon underwear, authentic right down to the symbols for people to buy and wear. Another issue or theme that has naturally attracted a significant amount of attention is the LDS Church's problematic history regarding race, specifically blacks in the priesthood. As early as Romney's first presidential run, the issue of Mormons and race had been raised by people like Lawrence Aldano, who had raged on a television show, and I'm not just trying to make it sensationalized. If you watch the television show, he was practically spitting. He was yelling so loudly. Raged on a television show about Joseph Smith, quote, who was a racist, who was pro-slavery, end quote. O'Donnell was either unaware of or didn't care that Smith and most Latter-day Saints were actually anti-slavery. Nor has that mattered this time around. As early as January of this year, Robin Blumner stated, quote, "The Mormon question is not irrelevant," end quote. He then went on to explain how the church until recently, quote, "practiced exclusion and contempt for African Americans," end quote. In April, MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell interviewed McKay Coppins about an article he had written in which he discussed a concerted effort by some of MSNBC's contributors to connect Mitt Romney to the church's difficult racial history. She asked if this was going to be a challenge for Romney, and Coppins confirmed that members of the black community were pressing Romney to speak out about the church's past practice of excluding blacks from the priesthood. When a questioner at a town hall meeting asked Romney, quote, "Do you believe it's a sin for a white man to marry and procreate with a black," end quote, O'Donnell later that evening commented on the event and then stated that Romney, quote, "sat in that church for 31 years while black men were denied the right to be priests," end quote. That is a question that people more than just O'Donnell have asked. Matthew Modine opined about how Romney reacted to the LDS Church's history of discrimination and then went on to defend the Reverend Jeremiah Wright's words as addressing the past sins of the United States. Modine's mentioning of Wright was similar to others who have argued, probably correctly, that Romney's campaign would be unwise to bring up Obama's connection to Wright, given the church's own problematic history. CNN's Roland Martin also suggested pursuing Reverend Wright would make Romney's Mormonism fair game, and another writer commented, quote, "Crazy as Wright sounds, Mormonism could scare Romney's base even more," end quote. In June, Chris Rock appeared on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon and brought up the church's controversial issue regarding race. Quote, okay, just heard this the other day. The Mormons, Mitt Romney's crew, they believed black people were the devil until 1978. I'm not making this up. Right, right, right? End quote. Spike Lee promised that there will be a block of people saying, I cannot vote for a Mormon because of this issue. He too promised that if Reverend Wright is brought up as an issue, it will be desperation on the part of Romney's campaign and will backfire for Romney. When Romney was preparing to speak at the annual NAACP convention, a video appeared charging Mormonism with racism and then stating, quote, about Romney, quote, you're so white, you make Wonder Bread look like pumpernickel, end quote. Tim King of the Salem News wrote an article titled, Why Did the Mormon Founders Hate Black People?, in which he accuses Romney of belonging to a cult-like religion that doesn't allow black people to serve in their upper echelons. Then, quote, Mormon history is one of racial bigotry. And then he went on to explain that the church had been created by early leaders, quote, full of shyster-like tendencies, created a religion so they could have multiple female sex partners, end quote, and then stated, quote, Mormons simply customized and in effect bastardized the words of God to fit the occasion, end quote. In an article titled Obama versus Romney, Mormon racist teachings will inspire record African-American turnout, it states, quote, the Romney campaign may have actually inspired an emotional connection that will result in another record turnout among blacks. Of course, this emotional connection is more of a negative one based on racial hostility, end quote. There are a number of other examples of articles, tweets, TV commentaries, and such from the left about a variety of different aspects of Mormonism. I had a much longer outline and realized that I had pretty much filled up my pages just with those, so I had to drop the others about different aspects of Mormonism. Almost daily, there are articles concerning Mitt Romney and real and imagined aspects of his Mormon religion. While much is middle of the road or harmless, some of it, as we have already seen, is not. As LeVar Webb wrote, quote, bigots of all types will always exist out there, and the prospect of a Mormon president has them slithering from under their rocks to attack the LDS Church, end quote. This presidential campaign cycle has already witnessed some of that bigotry from both sides of the political spectrum, and certainly there are varying reasons for critically analyzing Romney's religion and emphasizing the Mormon question based on political philosophy. As would be expected, criticism and condemnation for bringing up Romney's Mormonism has come from both sides, with some conservatives complaining that the Obama campaign, as Senator Orrin Hatch suggested back in April, quote, will use fear of the LDS Church against Romney, end quote. With the most recent kerfuffle regarding not only Romney's wealth, but also the church's finances and business dealings, and we've had some mention of that during the conference in the past 2 days with the Business Week cover and everything. Some people began to believe that perhaps these two evolving stories might actually be related. Joanna Brooks, who I might add is definitely no fan of Mitt Romney, the award-winning scholar and author questioned the imagery that both stories have, quote, conjured up one of the most unfriendly characterizations that has followed Mormons in American public life, that of secrecy and duplicity, end quote. Brooks went on, quote, could it be that by drumming up the question of what Mitt Romney is hiding, the Obama campaign is playing a bit of dog whistle politics? Surely they've done enough opposition research to know how Romney's religion is perceived, end quote. Other writers were less circumspect than Brooks. One writer discussed a series of articles published by the New York Times, including the most recent article claiming that the first families of Mormonism are the business families of Huntsman, Marriott, Rawlins, Gardner, and Neeleman, which I might add, you know, that came out right about the same time that the Business Week article came out. They accused the Times of, quote, doing the Obama campaign's dirty work for them, end quote. Another conservative opinion piece discussing the politics of polarization accused Obama of being, quote, engaged in partisan polarization on an industrial scale, which reflects the sensibilities of a particularly nasty 13-year-old, end quote. Now, whether or not the Obama campaign is involved in this kind of unsavory political machinations is debatable. And I might add that the Obama campaign has officially come out and said religion of either candidate is off limits. What is not debatable is that Mormonism is still a stumbling block for a portion of Americans, perhaps more so on the part of the political and social left. The 2012 presidential campaign is not over, and neither is the Mormon question. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Next, we're going to hear from Newell Bringhurst, and he is an independent scholar and professor emeritus of history and political science at the College of Sequoias in California, having retired after a 35-year career in the classroom. He was born in Salt Lake City, received his bachelor's and master's degrees at University of Utah. He's back at home today. And before attending University of California, Davis, where he received his PhD. He's the author and editor of 10 books published since 1981, and the most recent ones being the ones that we talked about with Craig. The Mormon Quest of the Presidency, 10 Mormons Who Ran for President and Why They Lost, and The Persistence of Polygamy, Joseph Smith and the Origins of Mormon Polygamy. He's a longtime member of the Mormon History Association, having served as its president in 1999 to 2000. He is also a member of the Utah Historical Society and actively involved with Sunstone going back to the mid-1980s. Newell.
Yeah, I'm going to try to do it from a somewhat different perspective. I'm looking at the 2012 campaign. I know that there's a lot of echoes in here. Does this sound okay? Is that the right modulation of voice? A lot better. I will try to keep that tone of voice as much as I can. I sometimes get a little animated. If I start misbehaving, you warn me like you warned Craig. Coming back here is sort of like a homecoming. It's really brought up a lot of fond memories. I was a student on this campus for more years than I should have been, probably. I started in 1960, received a bachelor's in 65 and a master's in 67. And so I spent the better part of a decade at this institution, and it's really changed a lot since that time. I probably spent more time in the student union than I should have, so it's kind of ironic that and I wasn't studying sometimes. While media attention has focused overwhelmingly on W. Mitt Romney, the presumptive Republican nominee, three other political figures with ties to the Mormon Church have also sought the nation's highest office. The three are John Meade Huntsman, Jr., a former Utah governor, who, like fellow Mormon Mitt Romney, sought the Republican nomination. The second is Ross C. Rocky Anderson, a one-time Salt Lake City mayor, who in late 2011 launched his own presidential campaign on a self-styled third-party ticket. And the third is Roseanne Barr, a one-time convert to Mormonism, believe it or not, and a television comedian who actively sought the Green Party nomination. This presentation will focus on four basic questions. Number one, what is the background and experience of each of these three candidates? What prompted each to seek the nation's highest office? Number three, how important is or was the Mormon question in the campaigns of each? And finally, a fourth question relative to each candidate. For John Huntsman, why did his campaign fail? For Rocky Anderson, who's still actively campaigning, what are his prospects for success and how much success in the fall? And for Roseanne Barr, why did she fail to secure a place on the Green Party ticket? First, John Huntsman Jr., without question, is the most prominent of the three candidates, possessing an impressive resume, both in politics and in the private sector. He first became involved in politics serving as a legislative intern for United States Senator Orrin Hatch, then as a staff assistant under President Ronald Reagan. Shortly thereafter, Huntsman returned to Utah, temporarily abandoning politics, assuming an executive position within the family-owned Huntsman Corporation. In 1989, he was lured back to Washington, D.C., following the election of George H.W. Bush, who appointed him Deputy Assistant Secretary within the Department of Commerce. And the following year, he was elevated to Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for East Asia and the Pacific. And then in 1992, he was appointed U.S. Ambassador to Singapore. Following President Bush's defeat in 1992, Huntsman returned once more to Utah, where he became president of the Huntsman Cancer Foundation. In 2001, Huntsman moved back to Washington, D.C., being named U.S. Trade Representative by newly elected George W. Bush. And then shortly thereafter, he was appointed United States Trade Ambassador. So you can see he's got a long resume of all of these are appointed offices. In 2003, Huntsman returned yet once more to Utah, this time to run for elective office, specifically governor of Utah. Successfully elected in 2004, and re-elected overwhelmingly 4 years later, Huntsman during his first term pursued a staunchly conservative agenda, which included tax reform, support of strict anti-abortion legislation, and legislation loosening the state's gun laws. He signed a measure voiding undocumented immigrant driver licenses. He strongly opposed Utah's implementation of the federal mandate, a No Child Left Behind education requirement. His advocacy of an aggressive pro-business agenda facilitated Utah's emergence as the second fastest growing state economy in the nation. On other issues, however, Huntsman took a more moderate stand. He relaxed the state's restrictive liquor laws and entered Utah into a multi-state agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. He also implemented an 18% increase in spending for education and proposed a plan to reform the state's health care system. All of these activities earned Huntsman praise from the Pew Center, which proclaimed Utah the best managed state in the Union. Following his re-election in 2008, Huntsman moved even further to the left, shocking Utah's political establishment by coming out in favor of legalizing same-sex unions and in promoting the federal economic stimulus program known as TARP, which was started by President Bush. Meanwhile, Huntsman assumed an increasingly active role in the national political arena. In 2008, he vigorously supported and campaigned on behalf of United States Senator John McCain's bid for the Republican nomination, opposing fellow Mormon and candidate Mitt Romney. That didn't earn him any friendship. Because even though they're cousins, they're distant cousins, actually. Not kissing cousins. But in 2009, Huntsman was tapped by President Barack Obama to serve as U.S. ambassador to China. Such an appointment, a complete surprise. Equally surprising was John Huntsman's decision to resign his ambassadorship in early 2001, or 2011, and return to the United States to run for president. Most political pundits speculate that Huntsman, who had actually previously indicated an interest in national office, would wait until 2016 to run. This raises a fundamental question. What factors caused Huntsman to seek the 2012 nomination rather than waiting for 4 years? There are several apparent motives. First, Huntsman apparently concluded that his prospects for securing the Republican nomination would be better in 2012, given the lack of a clear front runner, combined with a relatively weak field of contenders. Second, Huntsman may have also determined Barack Obama to be vulnerable in 2012. And a third possible factor may have simply been his desire to gain name recognition for a more serious run in 2016. A final interesting factor might have also been Huntsman's strong desire to oppose Mitt Romney, given the intense rivalry and indeed animosity between the two men. The fact of two former Mormon governors dueling each other for the GOP nomination raises yet another question. To what extent did the so-called Mormon question influence and inform John Huntsman as a presidential contender? Huntsman actually downplayed his Mormon faith. Although he served a two-year LDS mission to Taiwan, he was not a strict Mormon, confessing, "I can't say I'm overly religious. I get satisfaction from many different types of religious philosophies." He further stated that his Mormon beliefs were, quote, tough to define. A final bottom line question is, what caused Huntsman's campaign to fail? On a basic level, Huntsman was never able to establish himself as a viable alternative to Mitt Romney. This was the case despite the extreme volatility of the GOP primary contest, which we all remember, in which Romney, who was the acknowledged front runner, was challenged by a parade of major rivals. The list including, as we go back in time, Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, Texas Governor Rick Perry, Georgia businessman and pizza mogul Herman Cain, former U.S. House of Representatives, the wonderful, likable multi-married Newt Gingrich. He's my favorite. And finally, former Pennsylvania United States Senator Rick Santorum. John Huntsman, however, was never able to establish himself, in the words of the late, great Marlon Brando, as a major contender. Never could get there. John Huntsman's campaign failed for several reasons. First, the candidate himself conducted a generally lackluster campaign, lacking a clearly focused message. Second, Huntsman's moderate to liberal record as Utah governor was clearly out of step with the majority of Republicans. A third major impediment was the simple fact of Huntsman's two-year tenure as President Obama's China ambassador, which proved a negative to fellow Republicans. A fourth problem was that Huntsman was forced to compete with Mitt Romney, for the same center-right niche of party voters. This caused one political observer to acutely ask, what did Muntzman bring to the table that the vastly better known Romney did not already bring? Kind of a simple, oversimplified statement, but it was there. Given such liabilities, Huntsman's presidential campaign never caught fire, with national polls consistently placing him in the low single digits. Huntsman's poor showing in the crucial New Hampshire primary, where he concentrated his whole campaign effort, he finished a distant third, which compelled him to abandon his quest and endorse Mitt Romney. So that's John Huntsman going down in flames. Even more of a long shot candidate is Rocky Anderson, a former Salt Lake mayor. I didn't know much about Rocky Anderson before I got into this because I've lived in California since 1967, and both he and researching both he and Roseanne Barr for me was a real hoot. And he announced his candidacy on a self-styled third-party ticket. Anderson, elected Salt Lake City mayor in 1999, served two terms from 2000 to 2008. As mayor of Utah's capital city, he promoted an extremely progressive agenda, including climate environmental protection, immigration reform, restorative criminal justice, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights, and an end to the war on drugs. Anderson's decision to run for president on a third-party ticket was motivated in part by his disavowal of the Democratic Party, which he characterized as follows: gutless, unprincipled, and bought and paid for by the same interests that buy and pay for the Republican Party. Indeed, Anderson labeled the existing two-party system as corrupt and diseased, as well as militarist and corporatist. As for President Obama, Anderson accused him of total hypocrisy in dealing with the economy. Thus, Anderson chose to run for president as a third-party candidate, initially forming his own political organization, the Justice Party. On a whole array of issues, Anderson called for significant reform. I actually find his platform quite intriguing when you look at the things that he was proposing. It was really quite an impressive list of reforms. On the economy and jobs, he advocated renegotiating international trade agreements as a means to bring back jobs lost in other countries, along with a government-sponsored WPA-type programs to get people back to work and to repair the nation's infrastructure. I think those are pretty good ideas. In the area of financial reform, he advocates restoring the Glass-Steagall Act, ending antitrust exemptions for insurance companies, along with the breaking up of so-called too big to fail banks, and placing the Federal Reserve under the jurisdiction of the Treasury Department. In dealing with the environment, he calls for an outright ban on new coal-burning power plants. Most important, he feels the United States must assume international leadership in dealing with global climate change. Also, he supports a single-payer Medicare system of health care for all. To eliminate the corrupting influence of money in politics, he supports significant comprehensive finance reform. But one issue noticeably absent from Anderson's agenda is the so-called Mormon question. Not surprising, given that the former mayor has deliberately distanced himself from the LDS Church. Although raised Latter-day Saint and active during his growing up years, Anderson expressed strong disagreement with certain of its doctrines and practices, most specifically its now defunct policy of denying blacks the priesthood, enforced prior to 1978. At present, Anderson condemns the LDS Church position relative to gays and lesbians, comparing the Church's public campaigns against equality for members of the GLBT community with its earlier history of racial discrimination. As a third-party candidate, Anderson encountered significant obstacles in securing ballot access for his newly formed Justice Party. Anderson's effort was further complicated by the fact that he set a $100 limit for any individual campaign contribution. By April of 2012, the candidate had managed to secure ballot access in just three states, Utah, Mississippi, and Oregon, kind of an interesting trio of states. In the latter state, moreover, Anderson was listed not as the Justice Party candidate, but rather under the ballot line of the Oregon Progressive Party, an organization actually created back in 2008 to get Ralph Nader on the Oregon ballot. Some 2 months later, in late June, Anderson secured ballot access in New Mexico. Again, he was not listed as a Justice Party candidate, but rather under the ballot line of the Independent Party. Also, Anderson turned his attention to the all-important state of California in an effort to try to get on the ballot there. But he found ballot access there even more daunting. Here in California, he was compelled to run as the candidate of the Peace and Freedom Party, for the Peace and Freedom Party nomination in that state's June 5th primary. And in doing so, he found himself up against two other candidates also seeking the Peace and Freedom Party nomination. How many have heard of the Peace and Freedom Party? Its first candidate, interestingly enough, was Eldridge Cleaver, who also boasts a little bit of a Mormon connection, which we talk about in our book. But in running for he won the Peace and Freedom primary with 43% of the vote, but did not guarantee him the party's nomination, nor did it guarantee him a place on the November ballot. Given all of these difficulties in securing ballot access on a state-by-state basis, Anderson pursued a second option, direct nomination via the online Americans Elect process. How many are familiar with that? Remember that was going to be the new way of getting a good nonpartisan ticket. Well, Anderson declared this process a unique opportunity. The intent was that declared candidates of Americans Elect would be selected on the basis of their qualifications rather than the size of their campaign war chest. Citizens who signed up as delegates were to vote online without party affiliation during a series of caucuses scheduled for May 2012, eventually narrowing the field down to six candidates who in turn would select a running mate. The following month, an online nominating convention would be held to select the final American Elect ticket of a presidential and vice presidential ticket, which would be on the ballot in all 50 states in the fall. This sounds pretty good. Anderson admonished his backers to take advantage of this opportunity. We need everybody to take a few minutes and become a supporter for Rocky Anderson on the American Elect website. Unfortunately, the American Elect process did not work out. In May 2012, the whole process was suspended in response to the fact that no candidate met the necessary minimum criteria of 1,000 backers in each of 10 states. That was the threshold. In fact, just 402,000 people signed up with Americans Elect Online, with many of these people, individuals supporting little-known or quirky candidates, I'm quoting here, like former Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer or Libertarian Republican Ron Paul, the latter who had run in the Republican primaries and thus rejected the whole process, despite the fact that Paul received the most support. The bottom line was that Americans Elect were unable to recruit a heavyweight candidate with national stature. Rocky Anderson himself failed to meet the minimum criteria, all of his efforts notwithstanding. Thus, Rocky Anderson, as of late July 2012, has been compelled to return to his original strategy of seeking state-by-state ballot recognition via his own Justice Party. Anderson, in fact, recently selected a vice presidential running mate. How many people knew that? His running mate is Louis J. Rodriguez, a Los Angeles-based community activist. Rocky and Rod, right?
That sounds good.
Okay.
Inside story, I heard from a reporter in Cleveland that Dennis Kucinich was asking to turn him down.
Well, in summary, Rocky Anderson's prospects for success would appear to be minimum, if you want my frank opinion. Given his status as a fledgling third-party candidate, struggling to get on the ballot on a state-by-state basis, this underscoring the liability of all minor party candidates in this country. And I think it's something that really needs to be changed. The more I look at it, I think we need more choices. I'm just an editorial comment here. Anderson's struggling campaign, moreover, has attracted minimal media attention. Thus, it would appear that Anderson and his Justice Party will have little impact on the outcome of the November 2012 election. Now we come to my favorite candidate. How many remember Roseanne Vaughn? How many knew that she was a presidential candidate? Well, geez, we'll talk a little bit about the Roseanne show, okay? And so she is, as I say, she's running, and by contrast with Rocky Anderson, her colorful long shot campaign has received significantly more media attention than that of Rocky Anderson. Like Anderson, Barr was born in Utah, and like him, was a one-time active member of the LDS Church. But Barr's background is much different in that she was the granddaughter of immigrants from Europe and Russia and the oldest of four children in a working-class Jewish Salt Lake City family. Her parents, however, kept their Jewish heritage secret from their predominantly Mormon neighbors. In fact, the family was partially involved in the LDS Church, with Barr herself recalling the following: "Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning, I was a Jew. Sunday afternoon, Tuesday afternoon, and Wednesday afternoon, we were Mormons." She was attracted to Mormonism after her miraculous cure from an attack of Bell's palsy following a priesthood blessing. As an active Latter-day Saint, she gained her first acting onstage experience, performing before various Mormon audiences, and in fact was elected president of the LDS youth group to which she belonged. But her life suddenly changed at age 16, due to a traumatic brain injury, which she suffered as a result of a serious automobile accident, with her behavior altered so dramatically that she was institutionalized for a time in the Utah State Mental Hospital at Provo. Following her release in 1970, she left both Utah and her Mormon religion behind forever, moving to Colorado, where she commenced her career as a stand-up comedian. beginning in Denver nightclubs before moving on to Hollywood or to California and television. Her greatest fame came from her starring role in the television sitcom Roseanne, which lasted 9 seasons and garnered her both a Golden Globe and an Emmy. After her sitcom ended, she launched her own talk show, The Roseanne Show, and in 2005, she returned to stand-up comedy with a world tour. In 2011, she began a reality TV show called, you'll love this name, called Roseanne's Nuts. About her life, about her life on a 40-acre macadamia nut plantation, which she owns in Hawaii. I told you this was fun research. Barr's decision to run for president came in late 2011, although she had been hinting at the possibility a year earlier in May 2010. Speaking to a Washington, D.C. audience, in which she vowed, quote, to fix everything that is wrong with the world myself. I am tired of watching as men destroy all the world, she continued. Sadly, the current leaders of our world, 99% of them being male, you'll love this part, you women in here, are selfish idiots, boring cowards, greedy incompetents, or sexual degenerates who can't keep it in their pants ever. She stated, I declare patriarchal politics obsolete, and I call forth divine matriarchy as the only thing that can save this planet. How do you like that for a platform? Barr's formal 4th of August 2011 announcement came on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, where she proclaimed herself the candidate of her own self-styled political organization, which she dubbed the Green Tea Party. She dismissed the two major parties with the following epithet. They both suck, and they're both a bunch of criminals. She carefully noted that her candidacy was no joke. And totally serious. I'm sorry. I want to be part of the debates because I want to represent the taxpayers. In fact, I am choosing the taxpayers as my vice president. She then held up a bumper sticker with the following slogan, isn't it time we had a president with some nuts? Unquote. In February 2012, Barr shifted the focus of her presidential quest, abandoning her Green Tea Party and announcing her quest for the Green Party nomination, dropping the T. She found herself running against a field of three other candidates for the party nomination, the most formidable being Jill Stein, a Massachusetts-based physician and longtime party activist who had run for various statewide offices. Barr, in announcing her candidacy, promised, quote, I will barnstorm America, American living rooms. Mainstream media will be unable to ignore me. But more importantly, they will be unable to overlook the needs of average Americans in the run-up to the 2012 election. At the same time, she denounced the two major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, as servants of the rich and bought and paid for by the 1%. Barr recognized that her celebrity status would garner her significant media attention. She skillfully used the media, both in announcing her candidacy and in promoting her wish list of campaign proposals, doing it by Twitter to some 95,000 followers. Barr's willingness to exploit the media caused some political pundits to dismiss her candidacy. Quote, she's not a serious candidate, proclaimed one, explaining that if Barr was hoping to reach out for the youth vote, the demographics more often likely to respond to an insurgent third-party challenge Young voters simply don't remember her TV show. A second noted that Barr's considerable wealth conflicts just a tad with her self-identification as the flag bearer for the 99%. Yet a third dismissed her candidacy as a publicity stunt for her own proposed TV show, which was going to be called Downwardly Mobile. It takes place in a trailer park. That's the setting. Barr vigorously pushed her candidacy both in person and online over the following 6 months leading up to the Green Party National Convention. But at the same time, she was realistic about her chances, acknowledging her underdog status, going up against Jill Stein, the prohibitive favorite for the Green Party nomination. Despite this, Barr pushed ahead and actually enjoyed some successes. In late March, for example, she gained the backing of the Green Party Black Caucus. And in late April, Barr's candidacy was endorsed by the Green Party of Philadelphia. She also won a series of Green Party primaries in late May and early June, specifically those held in Georgia, Oregon, North Dakota, and South Dakota. She next looked toward the crucial June 4th California primary. Hoping to enhance her chances, Barr sought the support of another celebrity. She was looking for a vice presidential candidate. Guess who she asked? You'll never guess. Willie Nelson. She, in fact, asked the... But Nelson declined the offer, stating, quote, "I'm not really ready to get into politics. I'm content to sit on the sidelines and criticize everybody else." I love that. In the June 4th California primary, Barr finished a distant second with 40% of the vote, behind Jill Stein, who received 49%. Stein, with this victory, secured enough delegate support to clinch the Green Party presidential nomination in the first ballot. In response, Barr vowed to soldier on, continue her own candidacy, announcing via Twitter to run as an independent presidential candidate, resurrecting her Green Tea Party. But almost immediately thereafter, Barr changed her mind, announcing that she was still, in fact, a backer and campaigner for the Green Party. Barr's change of heart was apparently influenced, at least in part, by the rumor that Jill Stein was seriously considering her as a vice presidential running mate in advance of the Green Party National Convention in Baltimore, Maryland, scheduled for the 14th and 15th of July, which just recently concluded. But at the convention itself, Barr was passed over for the VP spot, with it going to a relative unknown, someone by the name of Sherry Honkala. Honkala is a Philadelphia-based anti-poverty activist and founder and national coordinator of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Now, in conclusion, Roseanne Barr's failure to secure the Green Party presidential nomination, or even land a spot on the ticket, was undoubtedly due, at least in part, to the fact that she was a political novice, and indeed a relative newcomer to the Green Party itself, her celebrity status notwithstanding. Moreover, the fact that she was a celebrity comedian could have in fact caused a majority of rank-and-file Green Party activists to be leery of her, and indeed question the legitimacy of her candidacy. This certainly appears to be the case, given that at the time of announcing her candidacy, Barr was still an active entertainer, promoting both her ongoing TV reality show as well as her proposed comedy series. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. Finally, we're going to hear a response from Bill Russell.
And Bill Russell is a retired professor of American history, religion, politics, and politics at Graceland University. He's widely published in Mormon studies. He's the former president of the John Whitmer Historical Association and the Mormon History Association. Many articles and reviews in Mormon studies. His recent book is Homosexual Saints, The Community of Christ Experience. And he has two books coming. One of them is on the recent schism in the community of Christ over women's ordination to the priesthood. And the other is on the 1989, is it Kurt murder?
Kirtland. Colt murder.
Okay, Kurt in Kirtland, Ohio. Anyway, both of those sound really interesting, and we'll hear next from him.
It's a pleasure to be associated with my two good friends, known as the odd couple of Mormon studies. Craig Foster, an Orthodox, temple-recommended Mormon who is employed by the church and is a conservative Republican and a member of the Utah State Republican Central Committee. And Newell Bringhurst, a Jack Mormon and a liberal Democrat. Jack Mormon and liberal Democrat. Now, if that ain't a surefire ticket to hell, I don't know what is. I have recommended their book, the book, The Mormon Quest for the Presidency. I have one of just two small bones to pick with it. I wouldn't include Eldridge Cleaver because his Mormon conversion came years after he ran for the presidency, so Mormonism had no effect on his campaign. Secondly, though, I do agree with the fact that these Mormon candidates, it's claimed that these Mormon candidates, they did come from a variety of political perspectives, but that doesn't demonstrate that Mormonism is a very diverse religion, because the liberals and the radicals, unless you count George Romney as a liberal, were not currently active in the church when they ran. What the heck? Sonia Johnson was a radical candidate. She was excommunicated from the church for lobbying for a liberal cause. Well, she hardly proved anything about the church. Huntsman was the only 2012 GOP candidate worthy of consideration for the next round in 2016. Often there's several repeat candidates, you know. Now, I'm acquainted with Rocky Anderson from serving on a Sunstone panel here in 1998. We exchanged our papers via the U.S. Postal Service after Sunstone. We both liked the criticisms that each of us had of the criminal justice system. I came back the next year, and I saw these signs around Salt Lake City. Rocky Anderson for mayor? I thought, Rocky, you'll never be elected mayor of Salt Lake City. You're a twice-divorced Jack Mormon. Now, I sent him a small financial contribution just to kind of give encouragement and moral support. And I completely forgot about his candidacy. And then after the election, I'm reading the New York Times. And there's a picture of Rocky, the new mayor of Salt Lake City. But I do regret he's running this year for president. His votes will only hurt Obama, but fortunately he won't get very many. The Roseanne Barr piece reminds me that typically we have about 200 or 300 candidates for president every cycle. You probably may not have known that. My all-time favorite was Billy Joe Clegg, a Springfield, Missouri man who ran every election for many years. And he also ran with Jesus Christ as his campaign manager. But Billy Joe didn't fire his campaign manager and hire somebody who has some competence. You know, Jesus was pretty good on religious issues, but his political skills apparently leave a lot to be desired. I invited one candidate to speak to my American President's class at Graceland. He came in with a dirty jacket but carrying in a box a carburetor. And he said, this carburetor will double your gas mileage, so he was going to be required on all federal cars and save us a bunch of money. I mean, he was really a very practical candidate. Another favorite was a nun bicycling across the country, a really grassroots campaign. One guy was a convicted felon. His first order as president would be to pardon himself, you know, the pardon me candidate. I think the third party candidates are sometimes worthy of voting for, even though I tend to make fun of a lot of them, like Roseanne Barr. But I think some people vote for minor parties to convince themselves and the others of their moral superiority. In the 1840s and 50s, I think it was very legitimate to vote for the anti-slavery parties, one of them, because the Democrats and Whigs were ducking this very most important issue. I can see myself voting third party back then, or 1912 and 1924, but most every other election, I don't see any real good reason to vote third party. And Ralph Nader in 2000 caused the election of George W. Bush far weaker on every issue that Nader cared about. We got two wars, two tax cuts, and rather than paying for the wars, and a big handout to the drug companies, an annual surplus turns into a massive annual deficit and a great recession. Now, turning to Craig's paper, Craig argues that anti-Mormon bias is stronger on the left than on the right. Hogwash. For one, it would be hard to prove, because it's hard to distinguish criticism of the Mormon religion and Mormon politics. There's an important difference. Mormons share much of the religious right's political agenda, but some on the right still condemn them for the religion anyway. But the political left disagrees with Mormonism on just about every political issue the Mormons have ever weighed in on. Liberals have watched the Mormons play a big role in defeating the Equal Rights Amendment, a very sad day for American women and for men and boys who love them. The political left has watched the Mormons challenge DOMA laws in the states and in Congress, and seen their efforts in Proposition 8 in California and an earlier referendum elsewhere, of California and elsewhere. A very sad day for American LGBT people and their family and friends who love them. So I think the liberal critique of Mormonism has as much to do with politics as with religion. Profoundly disagreeing with Mormon politics, it's natural for liberals to crack jokes about polygamy, or secret underwear, or secret temple rituals like baptism for the dead, to say nothing of the idea of eternal progression to godhood. It looks to me like Craig thinks everyone who makes fun of Mormonism is a liberal. Some are just comedians. And the jokes Craig cites in the first 8 pages of the partial draft I received 24 hours before leaving, well, that's pretty much what he read, so I have no problem there. Those are good jokes. Funny jokes. I think most unsworn Mormons would laugh at them. George Lopez's joke about how Mormon men need 6 wives to get the 12 kids that Latinos can turn out routinely, that was funny. Now, I presume that the name Lopez means he's Hispanic. He's joking about his own people as well as the Mormons. Maybe Craig is mostly offended by Lopez's use of the naughty F word. And Wanda Sykes is hilarious, saying that she leans toward Romney because Sykes, who's a lesbian, in a lesbian relationship, could use another wife to take care of the house. Bill Maher is an atheist and makes fun of all religions, as you can readily see if you watch his movie, Religious. He makes fun of Catholics, Protestants, Mormons, and I can't remember who all else, you know. I highly recommend this movie if you can laugh a lot, and especially if you can laugh at your own religion. I think a religion that can't laugh at itself has some maturing to do. Maybe our Latter-day Saint movement is just too young to develop an appreciation of humor about ourselves. Now, I was influenced here by Roy Chaville, my religion professor on many courses at Graceland. I later became presiding patriarch, and he indicated you need to be able to laugh about your religion, your own religion included. In fact, Chaville, when he talked about what you call the general authorities, in this case in independence, he would refer to the big boys in independence. They probably didn't think that was really respectful, I suppose, if they heard about it. Craig cites Alex Green's prediction that, quote, by the end of the presidential campaign, everyone who's ever made a magic underwear joke will be declared an intolerant liberal bigot. That's basically what Craig has done here, I think. One reason for the popularity of Roman Catholic and Mormon jokes is both churches are very hierarchical, authoritarian churches. America is a democracy. People used to democratic decision-making in the world of government and elsewhere notice the difference in decision-making in their hierarchical churches. Secondly, both religions have some really unusual practices. Catholic priests and nuns taking the vow of chastity and so forth, the doctrine of transubstantiation, you know, it's hard to get your mind around that. And both religions have had some significant sex scandals in recent years, and in both cases, church leaders have too often covered it up, ignoring the crisis of the children, or the cries of the children, in order to protect the church. For the Mormons, consult especially Volume 1 of the case reports of the Mormon Alliance, which Levina and Janice put together. Craig notes that Kevin Williamson of the National Review gave Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC the Golden Ass Award for first saying that Joseph Smith had 33 wives That's Todd Compton's conclusion. And next time it was 48 wives. That's Von Brody's conclusion. Well, now, if you're critical of polygamy, I don't see how it makes a real difference if Joseph had 33 or 48 wives. I really think Williamson seems to be more deserving of his own Golden Ass Award than O'Donnell. And what does that award itself say about Williamson? Craig cites with approval Doug Giles' article in Town Hall, where the title itself states his position. The media that ignored Obama's beliefs goes after Mitt's Mormonism. Is this guy serious? First of all, you can't assume that everyone in the press believes that all the ideas put forth by the preacher is believed by everybody in the congregation, you know, where Obama was occasionally attended. Does Giles not remember the barrage of media criticism of Obama and Wright, of course, in 2008 about his religion? And Obama, unlike Mitt Romney, has been very open about his religious beliefs. Meanwhile, Mitt has been hiding his light under a bushel for shame. Jesus warned us about that. Obama wrote about his religious beliefs in his second book, The Audacity of Hope. He formed much of his theology by reading two of the greatest Christian thinkers of the 20th century, Reinhold Niebuhr and Martin Luther King. Craig cites Giles' quite ignorant statement, quote, this is Giles, the same media that ignored information about Obama's racist religious roots, steeped in Marxism, is already queuing up with queries about Romney's Mormonism as somehow being weird and a tad white. I was appalled at the ignorance of much of the white media, left, right, and center, in 2008, in their criticism of Reverend Jeremiah Wright. They had no understanding of the Old Testament prophetic tradition, and clearly no understanding of liberation theology, a respected theological school of thought in Christian theology. Reverend Wright preached in the tradition of the Hebrew prophets, who brought the judgment of God not only on the sins of the other nations and tribes, but on the sins of his own nation. Give Amos a reading if you don't know what I mean. Reverend Wright condemned the sins of white America. There's nothing racist about that. And to call Obama racist, as guys like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck have done often in ignorance, to put it politely, or better, it's bigotry on their part. Reverend Wright's theology is basically Orthodox Christian theology. Mormon theology is not. So whose religion is weird? Reverend Wright's or Mitt Romney's? In response to Montana Governor Schweitzer, who seemed to suggest that Mitt's grandfather was a polygamist, Mitt, in his typical fashion, got angry and said, my dad's dad was not a polygamist. But he didn't want to say, it was my dad's dad's dad, and my dad's dad's dad was a polygamist. Mitt has conveniently tried to hide the reason for the Romney's family move to Mexico. And they were lawbreakers, fleeing the realm. That's fair game for discussion and criticism, and for humor. Frankly, that angry response seems juvenile to admit. Craig does note that North Carolina State Representative, who said Mormons are still polygamists, apologized when she recognized she was in error. Craig seemed to expect non-Mormons to know a lot more about Mormonism than they do. But Mormons aren't exactly known for their in-depth knowledge of other religions. Well, lots of Mormons think still, you know, lots of people think Mormons still practice polygamy, and about 50,000 fundamentalist Mormons do. But they're kicked out of the church, of course, the LDS church, when they're found out. But it should be no surprise that many outsiders aren't aware of that distinction. Why, at my own church, the Reorganized Church, we began in the 1850s with our central complaint against the Utah branch is polygamy. Opposition to that has been the central reason for our existence for a long time. But through most of our history, many Gentiles assume that we practice polygamy. Now, some even believe it today, although hopefully not very many. That makes me really mad. Yeah, not really. As a Massachusetts politician, Mitt Romney's Mormonism didn't appear to cost him politically in that liberal state. When he was a candidate for Senate in 94 and governor in 2000. But we've seen that his Mormonism cost him votes in the Iowa Republican caucuses and other primaries this year. And so he, in Massachusetts, he differed with his church. Now he's not willing to show any light whatsoever. So just to sum up, I don't think Craig has made the case that he sets out to make. Thank you.
About 10 minutes.
Thank you. Yeah, we've got about 9-10 minutes for questions. I'd ask that when you have a question, please come up and use this mic so that it can be included in the recording. And please keep your question to a question so that everybody has an opportunity to ask their questions. And maybe you can share your own political perspectives with our speakers after the session.
Are these working?
I believe it's working. Do you want to go ahead and try it?
Hello? No, I don't.
Flip it on.
Let's just...
Oh,
okay, there we go. All right, so if you have questions, please come forward and ask it in the mic and direct it to one of our speakers.
Right.
No questions, huh?
Maybe Craig would like to respond.
Yeah, you want to respond, Craig?
No.
Mark.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you take that one. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Maybe just have a mic because everybody else has.
Whatever. Neil, I appreciate your observations about all cannabis, certainly Hudson, and I think that as an observer of the political scene, Hudson probably had the greatest attraction to independent voters, and I don't see that Mormonism would have been as big an issue with him because of his more independent thought than that of loyalty of Romney or the position. But I have a question that goes to Craig. You cite Cal Thomas, but I was wondering why you cite Rush Limbaugh as the voice of the Republican Party. He seems to have been, had very wide audience. He can be very, very respectful in his opinions among supporters of the Republican Party. So I just was curious because I kept waiting for you mentioned so many other ones who were voices of the Republicans, but you didn't mention Rush Limbaugh's opinion.
Rush Limbaugh is not the voice of Party. Rush Limbaugh is the voice of a conservative part of the Republican Party. If you pay attention to what the establishment Republican Party says, while they respect the fact that Rush Limbaugh has a lot of influence, they still don't consider him the voice of the Republican Party. Now, the reason why I didn't quote him, they didn't have any good quotes. I thought that the two quotes fit in. I mean, if I was going to write a whole book, yeah, okay, I'd probably go and look at Rush Limbaugh's site and find some quotes, but for saying what I wanted to say, Cal Thomas and Doug Giles, which I might add, that I commented that I thought that particularly Giles was a lot of hyperbole, but
so what's your criteria for voice of Republicans? Cal Thomas evidently has those criteria. Rush Limbaugh doesn't. Can you repeat the question?
I'm sorry. Oh yeah, okay. So what is my criteria for voice of the Republican Party? In my opinion, voice of the Republican Party would be someone who is from the Republican Party leadership or something like that. Voice of the conservative movement? Absolutely. Rush Limbaugh is certainly voice of the conservative movement. But even Rush Limbaugh himself will take pot shots at the Republican Party when he feels that they're not being conservative. Rush Limbaugh will more often than not say that he's the voice of the conservatives. Cal Thomas is also, I would consider, more the voice of the conservatives. I wasn't saying he was the voice of the Republican Party. I said he was a conservative. And where that appeared, which is on Town Hall Daily, is a conservative, website, which I would say at least half of the stuff, more than half, I don't agree with. So that's how I differentiate.
Well, Rush Limbaugh once called Senator Hatch, the latter-day liberal, because of his support for health care with Ted Kennedy. And I was surprised that church members just let it go, like, well, Rush is a good guy, and he's probably a better guy than Hatch, so let's just let it go. Had Maher called Hatch the latter-day moron, you would have seen an uproar, calls to get Maher's show off of TV, etc. So there does seem to be a double standard among the Mormon community.
Yeah. My paper didn't have to do with double standard. And if you want to read what I say about the conservatives, read my stuff. I have gone after them plenty of times. And as for latter-day liberal or whatever, actually, I wrote for Rush Limbaugh a scathing email, not on that, but when he was going on about how, why would Lauren Hatch not support freedom to smoke wherever you want? He obviously is being paid off, and I wrote and said, well, look at his religious background, and maybe you'll have an idea why he is against smoking. There's a bunch of, it depends on the issue. So.
Look, Hatch is out with the big recipients of tobacco company donations, so maybe Rush will attach, I'm sorry, say it fair soon.
Yeah, Rush should know that part.
One more question?
You can.
This question may be devoted more to Newell, but I invite everybody else to participate. I can't help but wonder if John Huntsman didn't throw his hat in the ring mostly just to get some initial name recognition,
yeah,
where his real effort is going to be in 2016.
Yeah, I mentioned that in my paper because that's what a lot of people theorized when he formally announced in early 2012 was that he was really gearing up for, early 2011, that he was really gearing up for 2016. Although I think he was also looking at Plan B, because as I also further suggest in my paper, it looked like, Obama was vulnerable, and as we well remember, the Republican field was a pretty weak field. I think that's why Romney was able to emerge on top for a lot of the reason. He had a very well organized and very well focused campaign, but I looked at most of those candidates running the Republican Party and it almost like a freak show. From my perspective, but you got somebody like Herman Cain being seriously considered as a presidential contender. I mean, he was a joke, and Newt Gingrich, in my opinion, was downright pathetic. I mean, Bachman was an interesting candidate. She certainly was an ideological matriarch of the Tea Party movement. I think I give her greater legitimacy than I give Newt Gingrich or even Rick Santorum. It's surprising. The one that really surprised me the most, in fact, my wife and I made a bet on this. I told my wife, I said, I bet, who I think is going to be the 2012 Republican candidate? And he wasn't even mentioned initially. It was Rick Perry. I really thought Rick Perry would do much better because by virtue of his record of 10 years as governor of Texas, and it wasn't that, it was a fairly respectable record, comparable to Huntsman's record in Utah. I was shocked that he flamed out the way that he did. He was a legitimate candidate who didn't go anywhere.
This is just my opinion. I think Rick Perry came in, he had had relatively easy campaigns in Texas, and so I think he came in thinking, oh, this will be pretty easy, and he learned quickly that it's when you go into the big time, it's a lot tougher. I think that he'll come back as a candidate and probably be a lot stronger as a candidate. I don't think I'll like him any more than I did this time, but I think that will be the case. One thing really quickly, then I'll pass it on to you. Regarding the voice of the Republican Party and all of that, for what it's worth, and this is just my opinion, of the three major talk radio people, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Glenn Beck, you have, I would say that Rush Limbaugh is the overall conservative movement, that he is definitely kind of the voice of that. As I said, he takes pot shots at the establishment of the Republican Party all the time. You have Glenn Beck, who can't stand any of the parties, and it's very libertarian. He's a conservative voice, but from a more, niche market. And if you're going to get the voice of the Republican Party, it's actually Sean Hannity, because he pretty much down the line will go with the Republican candidate, no matter who it is. And so that's based on my listening to him for what it's worth.
Yeah, I think Rick Perry, like Newell said, first of all, he was an accidental governor in first year governorship and so on, right? So he's always running for sort of re-election, I'd say. But his father was, he was really an overzealous base. It was a disaster of the base. As far as I'm concerned, I think that might have been his plan, the test assessment in 2016. It sort of failed, though, to my regret. Because I think when he did so poorly, of course, he really made one mistake. It did come in third there, with other folks. But when he did so poorly, not just so soon, he might not be taken seriously in 2016. But also, if he had been, I think his ambassadorship to China was a tremendous qualification. But of course, it was for Obama, so that was a disqualification. But if he'd been ambassador under George Bush to China, he'd been tremendous. There's a huge parts of the world, and we need to understand China, and he understands China. He respects Chinese culture and knows the language really well, and he would have been in foreign policy. He was the only Republican that I think is worth listening to.
Yeah, I would say he was the Republican that Democrats love the most.
I guess that's it. Huh?
Yeah, Newell, Craig, and Bill, thank you very much for your time.